Number 917.
Good morning. Glad to see all of us here this morning. Appreciate you determining in your heart this is where you needed to be this morning and that you've joined us today. Last week, Mike mentioned in his sermon about the Epicureans. And I'm always, I chase rabbits a lot of times. And I didn't know much about the Epicureans, and he got me kind of curious about them. And so I wanted to know about what they believed and what they profess to believe. And so I want to spend a little bit of time about, just in the beginning, about the Epicureans, but then how we need to be aware of their influence still even in today's life. And I think as I go forward, you'll kind of get the understanding of where I'm heading with this. Well, the Epicureans get their name from a gentleman named Epicurus. He was born about around 340 or so years before the time of Christ. So by the time Christ came around, his philosophies had been very widely disseminated and spoken about. Now, when you think about it, and I do need to add that he was based out of Athens. He taught there and philosophized. I don't know if that's a word, but I'm making it up. He philosophized there in Athens. Now, his thoughts were very, his teachings were very deep, but you could kind of boil it down to a couple points here. One was that the world was not made by any one deity, and that it was made without any design. So they didn't necessarily deny that there were lower G gods in the world. They just didn't think these gods had any bearing over a human's day-to-day activities, that there was no providence over human affairs. They didn't influence or impact or change what happened here on earth. Ultimately, they did not assign any role in a person's immortality or anything about that would happen, because I think I talked about they didn't believe in an afterlife, so there was no role for a god to play in that case. He taught that the greatest good in life was to seek modest, sustainable pleasure. This often was in the form of a state of tranquility and a freedom of fear, something that didn't cause bodily pain. It was done through knowledge of how the world worked and by limiting desires. A lot of people think Epicureans think that they taught, everything was they could do. I mean, anything you could think of that was good to do, you could do as long as it didn't cause pain. Well, really, they did have some moderation in their beliefs about this pleasure. And so the combination of all these thoughts in their mind constituted happiness in its highest form. Now, the pleasure was the chief good in life, but they said that you should derive the greatest amount of pleasure as possible during one's lifetime. But as I mentioned, they thought it needed to be done moderately. This was done in order to avoid the suffering incurred, oftentimes by overindulgence in things of this world. And the emphasis was placed on pleasures of the mind rather than on the physical. Further, Epicurus sought to eliminate the fear that came from wanting to please a god and fear that most people associated with death. These were what they, in his teaching, these were the causes of great strife and stress in people's lives. And he sought to eliminate that in people's psyche. He recommended against passionate love and believed it honestly best to avoid marriage altogether, not to engage in that if at all possible. But Epicureanism, as I mentioned earlier, they do reject immortality. The belief is that the soul is mortal and material, just like the body, that will not pass on to any kind of an afterlife. We find account of Epicureans being found in the New Testament, If you want to turn to Acts chapter 17, verses 16 through 21, Paul is in Athens. This is in Epicurus's hometown. Surely this was a center of Epicurean thought and teaching. And we're told in verse 17 that, we're told here that the Epicureans, along with the Stoics, were present when Paul was there one day. I'm going to begin reading there in verse 16. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons, and in the marketplace every day with those who happened to be there. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. And some said, "What does this babbler wish to say?" Others said, "He seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities," because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting? For you bring some strange things to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean." Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. These people did exactly what that last verse said. They like to get together and share different philosophies, different minds of thought. And they thought it was important to be knowledgeable about other people's thinkings, that maybe they could incorporate it into their life and into their own thoughts. They really didn't mind hearing opposing views. So Paul then goes on and talks about his beliefs and what he tells them there. And he concludes his remarks by focusing on the fact that the earth was created by God and was governed, you know, and watched over by God. When we get to verse 30 and 31, Paul tells them that not only does God exist, but that they, along with everyone else, was called to repentance. That day of judgment faces them, us today, and he went on to say this was proven by the fact that Jesus, the Son of God, was risen from the dead. At this point in time, the Epicureans start mocking Paul, because as I mentioned earlier, they didn't believe in the afterlife. They were staunchly opposed to this concept, let alone the fact that anyone would be resurrected, that after dying, they'd be raised from the dead. So they were very, very adamant in their mockery of Paul. Now, the poet Horace was a follower of Epicurus. And maybe, well, why am I bringing up the poet Horace? Well, Horace came up with a very common phrase that we hear from time to time, carpe diem, which means seize the day. As a follower of Epicurus, this fit that philosophy very, very well. It's actually, carpe diem is part of a larger phrase, which is carpe diem quam minimum credula postero. And when that is all put together, it means seize the day, put very little trust in tomorrow. The meaning is that the future is unforeseen. You can't be guaranteed that you'll be here tomorrow. So you should not leave to chance any future happenings. Any chance to have pleasure today should not be abandoned, because tomorrow you might not have that opportunity. You should do all that you can today to make one's own future, you know, if that would come about, make that better. Now, from time to time, Mike likes mentioning a commercial that talks about going for the gusto. Well, that's kind of, you know, along the lines of what this is talking about. And I looked, and it was actually a part of a large ad campaign for a beer company. And the full tagline was, "You only go around once in life. So you've got to grab for all the gusto you can." Does that not sound like what Epicurus taught? You may not be here tomorrow. You only go around once. You've got to do what you can with what you have. Turns out that ad campaign began in 1970 and continued for a very long time. That just proves that not only am I old, but Mike is old too, because I remember that clearly. So, but the same concept that Epicurus, you know, proposed that Horace said was carpe diem, and which this beer company said go for the gusto. That same concept, while not worded the same, still is very much stressed today. You young people have a phrase for it, and I say young people, anyone under 40, you're grinning, I think you know where I'm going with this. And that phrase is, people over 50, you may or may not have heard of this, so we'll leave it up. But the phrase I'm going with is, oh wow, I missed a lot of things, my bad, sorry. Yep, YOLO. YOLO just stands for, you only live once. Generally used to mean that you should do something that otherwise might be considered foolish, or that you might not have another chance to do, or even more dramatically, you might be doing something that you could die doing this. It's something so extreme or whatever, you know, jumping off a cliff with a bungee cord wrapped around you, or whatever the case may be. You only live once. You might die what you were doing, but you need to go for it, regardless of whatever risk is there. Now, for you older folks, you may not know about YOLO, but I'm sure you've heard of the 60 sentiment, it's better to burn out than to fade away. It's the same concept. So with this in mind, I want to transition into how we could be aware of this influence in our lives, how we could apply this to our lives today. Because while in essence we should reject the overall thoughts of Epicureanism, we should adopt one key essential part of that, and that is, we really do only live once. How do I know that we do? Well, Hebrews chapter 9, verse 27 says, and just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment. This passage says we are to die once. So you have to take the opposite position that if we only die once, it means we only live once. So I've got 3 points on this, and the lesson will be yours. Since we do only live once, let's not spend it filled with worry. We've all worried about something in our lives. I'm not going to stand up here and say that you shouldn't ever worry or that there's nothing ever worthy of being worried about. If a loved one is ill or has possibly passed on, maybe you've lost a job or your car's broken down and you're not sure how you're going to be able to get to work this week, whatever the case may be. There are things that are worthy of being worried about, as long as it's a productive worry and you're worrying about and thinking, trying to think of a solution or whatever the case may be. But I think we all know people, if we're honest with ourselves, maybe sometimes we're not happy unless we have something to worry about. There are just some people that they are just constantly seeking out stressors in their life. They're thinking out of ways to just get themselves worked up. When you get down to it, worrying kidnaps our normal pattern of thinking. It hijacks our mind. The word worry actually comes from an old English word that means to strangle or to choke. If you think about that, worrying can choke out the things in this world and the things in our life about which we should be focusing or should be thinking about. But this worry just causes us to lose focus on that. It chokes out the world from us, and it chokes out the peace that we should have in our lives. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 25 says, anxiety in a man's heart weighs him down, but a good word makes him glad. Worry will wear us down to the point where we don't get comfort from anything. We don't get any satisfaction from anything because we're so consumed on this negative thing that may be impacting our lives right at this point in time. And for like I said, there are people that just are constantly in a state of worry, and it results in them having a terrible, you know, quality of life. You know, just their life in general is suffering. Jesus, on the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6, verse 27 says, and which of you, by being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life? Worrying doesn't help you one bit. It could potentially help you, if you're spending enough time on it, think of a solution, but lot of people who are worried are just worrying for worrying's sake. And it certainly doesn't add anything to your life. And from a spiritual standpoint, it takes away the glory that God gives us and that we should be giving to God, because we're focusing on the negative instead of focusing on what the blessings that he provides to us. We can lose focus by dwelling on the negative on our life. And for many people, it helps them lose sight of their eternal goals. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verses 6 through 7 says, "For this reason, I remind you to fan into flame the gift of God, which is in you through the laying on of my hands. For God gave us a spirit not of fear, but of power and love and self-control." God does not expect us to go through life timidly, worried, scared. Instead, we're given a spirit, it says, of power. Power to encounter our foes and our dangers and our worries. Power to bear up under trials that we go through regularly through this life. And the power to triumph when we are persecuted for what we believe. The nature of the gospel is there to inspire us, to help encourage us through the times where we are being given tribulation in our life. Now, we're also given a spirit of love. Love to God and to each other. Nothing really we could do will inspire courage in us to make someone fearless of danger or ready to endure persecution than love. The love of Christ is there to sustain us through these valleys and through the peaks. As we go through good times and bad, love of Christ can help us through all of these times. Then it says the last thing that we are given a spirit of is self-control. This is having a sober mind, a mind that is well balanced in what we are focusing on. It means we have the right influences in our life and we are acting upon those right influences. The influences that we should be avoiding are those that would cause us to be worried or become excited or agitated. But when everything is in its proper place, we have self-control and we have the Spirit in us. Now, the next thing we need to keep in mind that we think about what we only living once is that we should be living in this world with a purpose. Brother Jim's class on Wednesday night touched on the concept of the world. And through that discussion, we kind of talked about how the world is more than just the physical earth on which we are living. It's the situation that we are in based upon the society in which we live. It's a situation that we're exposed to, and oftentimes it's the environment in which we choose to spend our lives. Once again, we turn to the Sermon on the Mount. If we go to Matthew chapter 5, verses 13 through 16. "You are the salt of the earth, but if salt has lost its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled under people's feet. You are the light of the world. A city set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do people light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a stand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before others, so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven." We all understand about salt, you know, the flavor, you know, that it offers. You know, but you ever really wonder why he calls us the salt of the earth? Like I said, most of us only think of one use of salt, which of course is to make our French fries taste better. But throughout history, salt was not that common a commodity, but it was used many times as a preservative. It would keep your food to last for a very long time. So if you think about it, that's really how we should be looking about how we can be salt in the earth. We're not making the earth taste better or the world taste better, but we should be looking at it as we should be trying to preserve this earth. in the sense that the foundation that's laid out in the gospel, the foundation that's laid out by the apostles in the writings that they gave us, we should be in this world with a purpose of preserving that in this earth. We shouldn't be actively doing things that will counteract that or be leading to the mockery that we saw the Epicureans give to Paul, but we should be out there living our lives trying to preserve this concept of salvation in the world. It falls upon us to be the pourers of that foundation. And how do we pour a foundation? By being good examples, by shining our light, as the passage in Matthew 5 transitions into. We do that by being a light unto the world, by setting the proper moral examples that we find based in the foundation of the gospel, to which we should be preserving. We can't help but be noticed by doing that. We're told we will be a peculiar people because we will stand out. That light will be seen. And so we need to take our light into the world and shine it wherever we see darkness. That whether we're intentionally doing it or just by being the type of person that you should be, shining that light into the darkness. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 6 through 11 tells us, "Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not become partners with them, for at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of light is found in all that is good and right and true. And try to discern what is pleasing to the Lord. Take no part in the unfruitful works of darkness, but instead, expose them." We cannot be casting our life if we ourselves are living in darkness. Since we only live once, let's live in the light of the Lord. And we do that by walking as children of His, of light. Now, the last point regarding only living once is we should make sure that we're living with an eye on our reward in heaven. Jesus himself tells us in John chapter 14 that we have a home reserved and waiting for us. You go there in John chapter 14, verses 2 and 3. He says, "In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, would I have told you that I go to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and will take you to myself, that where I am, you may also be." You may be also. He then goes on to say that the only way to his earthly home is through him. Verse 6 says, "He is the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through him." Paul backs this statement up with a similar thought in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 1 through 10. 2 Corinthians 5. "For we know that if the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened, not that we should be unclothed, not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. He who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. So we are always of good courage. We know that while we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord, for we walk by faith, not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please Him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil." Regardless of all the persecutions and trials we face here on earth, we're told here that the sufferings are all going to be worth it on one condition: if we're faithful. We'll cast off this physical tent, this body that burdens our lives, And we're going to inherit and inhabit a building from God, a house not made with anyone's hands. But before we can claim our earthly home, we are told in verses 9 and 10, we have to make out our desire, our goal to please him. Romans chapter 14, verse 18, I don't have it up here, but it says, whoever thus serves Christ is acceptable to God and approved by men. Serving Christ gets us that much closer to our home. And all of us will stand before Christ as he sits on the judgment seat. We will receive the reward that we've earned based upon the goodness or the evil that defined our lives. The good will gain access to this home that we're promised. The evil gain access, well, it'll be their home, but that home will be a lake of fire that is promised to us in Revelation. So with these thoughts in mind, we can be certain of one thing. They may not call themselves that or this, but there are Epicureans in this world still today. They're everywhere we go, every place we visit, they are among us. These people seek to find purpose only in pleasure are abundant. People who pridefully promote the self-sufficiency and self-direction of mankind are also plentiful. The answers that Paul gave to the Athenians in Acts chapter 17 are still good answers for today. That this world was created by a benevolent God who desires that we seek him. That this God will hold us accountable for how we live our lives. But he's provided a way to find him, and that is through the life, the death, and the resurrection of his Son. Now, YOLO, or you only live once, is a reference to doing something, as I mentioned, usually associated with danger or risk. Usually a physical harm, something along those lines. But not receiving and obeying the gospel in your life is the most dangerous thing you could possibly ever do. This one life we have to live is one that should be a life of service, of dedication to him. So we have that hope that we can look for, that hope of an eternal life with him in heaven. But if we are living our life just for ourselves, for our own selfish reasons and ambitions, we cannot count on that home being there. It's a dangerous game you play, thinking, well, I'll be baptized sometime in the future. Not now, I'm living my life, I'm young. It's a dangerous game you play. Shelley and I watch weird things on YouTube, and last night we were watching famous people who had died in the past year, in 2019. Not that that's stupid, but just the things you find out there to watch. And we would see, you know, so-and-so, age 86, passed away. And then they'd say, so-and-so died age 27. And Shelley would get her phone out, and she'd go, look, how'd that guy die so young? The 86-year-old people, we didn't look up. They're 86 years old. They died of old age. But 27? That's young. He died of a motorcycle accident, one person we looked up. The point I'm saying here is that you may think you're going to live to 86 and you've got plenty of time. Or you might be that 27-year-old man that died of a motorcycle today. You just don't have any, you don't have any control over that. We talked about the self-control that comes through the power of Christ, but that is one area we don't have any self-control over. So as you think about whether or not you're going to live tomorrow, let alone to age 86, realize you need Christ in your life. You need to accept him as your Savior. You need to confess his name. You need to repent of the sin in your life, and you need to be buried in the waters of baptism. If we can be of assistance to anyone this morning, I ask you to please come as we stand and as we sing.